This is Audible.
The Mental Game of Poker. Proven strategies for improving tilt control, confidence, motivation, coping with variance, and more. Written by Jared Tindler with Barry Carter. Narrated by Jared Tindler with contributions from Barry Carter and John Newcomb.
Acknowledgements. I've been fiercely independent throughout my life, so when I first set out to write this book, I thought I could do it on my own. I was overconfident. If not for the following people, this book would not have become a reality. I'd like to thank Barry Carter, co-author, for helping turn my ideas and experience into something that would make sense for poker players. As a poker journalist, poker player, and one of the best people I know, Barry forced me to be clearer and more detailed when making a point. His enthusiasm and patience pushed me to write a better book, one that I am proud to include both of our names on. Although the original material for this book was not Barry's, his contribution was invaluable, and he made it his own. He was the perfect person to help me write the book I envisioned. I'd like to thank my clients for sharing their stories in this book. Dusty Schmidt, Neiman Kenkry, Liz Herrera, Matt Bolt, Jordan Morgan, Mike Song, Pascal Tremblay, and Sean Gibson. Your honesty and willingness to share your stories ultimately brought this book to life. I'm also extremely grateful to all of my clients for giving me the opportunity to refine my methods and techniques. In particular, Dusty Schmidt, my first poker client, who helped me understand the nuances of high-level poker, introduced me to the poker community, and translated my work from golf to poker. There are a number of pioneers, such as Dr. Alan Schoonmaker, Tommy Angelo, and Matthew Hilger, who solidified the place of psychology in poker. They advanced the field and made it far easier for poker players to accept the importance of the mental game. Without the love and ongoing support of my parents, sister, and brother-in-law, this book may have never been written. Thank you for always encouraging me to pursue my dreams, helping me persevere when it was tough, laughing at me for taking so long, and still thinking I could do it. Thank you, Corey Karsh, for believing in me, lending your expert writing skills, and making the greatest accomplishment of my life more fun. Thank you, Alexis Nahum, for generously giving of your time, no questions asked. You went above and beyond and really stepped up when I needed you. You truly helped to lighten the load, and your support and expertise were invaluable. I will be forever grateful. A number of friends and family members also spent hours reviewing portions of this book. Jay Kotlin, Sue Kotlin, Ronit Glantz, Melissa Nagin, Ben Nagin, Paul Bakanovic, Sharon Hershick, Andy Hershick, and Kira Karsh. Thank you for giving up your days, nights, and weekends to make this book easier for others to read. Thank you, David Horn, Diana Murphy, Scott Brown, Evan Rothman, Hunter Bick, Poker News, Jake Poignier, and Tyler Kirkendall. For a variety of reasons, you helped make this book happen. Chapter 1, Introduction. Players who are successful in the mental game of poker use a strategy that's proven to work for them. They have a structure and a methodology in how they approach the mental game and don't need to rely on a lucky rabbit's foot or praying to the poker gods. If there were no way to control whether you play in the zone or go on tilt, my work as a mental game coach would be nothing more than blowing smoke up your ass. Tilting and playing your best happen for predictable reasons and occur in predictable patterns. As a poker player, you profit from your ability to analyze the patterns and habits of your opponents. Using the tools provided in this book, you will develop the ability to study the patterns and habits in your own mental game. The fact that so many players have benefited from working on their mental game, whether from my advice or others, is proof that success in the mental game comes down to skill, as poker does. However, many players think tilt, fear, motivation, and confidence happen for random, illogical, or irrational reasons. As a result, they say or think the following. Logically, I know variance happens, so it's stupid to tilt from a bad beat. For some reason, I decided to play like a donkey last night. I'm running really bad. Maybe I should take a break. I always play my best game on full tilt. After being up big, I somehow managed to spew off a few stacks. I wish I could play as well as I did today, all the time. If you think the mental game is random, you simply lack the skill to see how it's predictable and rational. Skilled poker players are easily able to see how the actions of weaker opponents aren't random. They pick up on betting patterns, timing tells, physical tells, and verbal tells, which allows them to exploit the games of weaker players. Weaker players don't have the skill to see the predictability in their game. The same is true in the mental game. Right now, you probably don't have the skill to recognize the actions, thoughts, and emotions that lead you to play your best or worst. That makes you a mental game fish. Thankfully, you were able to evolve from being a poker fish, and with the right information, you can do the same with your mental game. With poker more competitive than ever, more players are turning to the mental game as a valuable way to create an edge. Creating edge is not a new idea, of course. It has just become more important in poker over the past several years as the number of quality poker players has risen dramatically. Thanks to websites such as 2+2, CardRunners, and others, the way the game is played has changed forever. Now, with the player pool so deep, parts of the game that weren't taken so seriously even just a few years ago, such as the mental game, are now a necessity. Golf sets the stage. Athletes in all major sports face the same challenge to stay ahead of their competition. While it's rare that a sport evolves as quickly as poker has, professional golfers recently went through something similar when Tiger Woods took the golf world by storm in the late 1990s. As he swept through the professional ranks, he brought a new set of rules that forced other professional golfers to take fitness and the mental game more seriously. Prior to Tiger's emergence in golf, only a few of his peers looked at fitness as essential to their game. Many players were out of shape, and so golf wasn't always looked at as a real sport. Tiger also had a level of focus, determination, and confidence that further separated him from his competition. The combination of his physical and mental prowess forced other players on tour to follow his lead in order to remain competitive. Tiger forever changed the way professionals approached the game. Now nearly every golfer on the PGA Tour and other major professional tours has a physical trainer and a sports psychologist or mental game coach. It's become the new standard. As a successful amateur golfer in the late 1990s, I had aspirations to become a professional. There was only one big problem. I kept choking under pressure in national tournaments. 1 month after Tiger won his first major title, I choked trying to qualify for my first major. Shortly after completing my freshman year at Skidmore College, where I won two tournaments, I played in the first stage of qualifying for the U.S. Open in 1997. Over the 18-hole qualifier, I played some of the best golf of my life, except on the greens. My putting was horrendous. I three-putted four times and missed several putts from short range. I shot an even par 71 and missed getting into a playoff by one shot. It was tough coming so close, only to have my nerves get the better of me. But I wasn't going to let that stop me. I kept practicing hard, and then one day later that summer, I was describing my struggles to a friend when his eyes lit up. He knew immediately that I needed to read a book that he had just finished. He ran to the locker room and returned a few minutes later with his copy of Golf is Not a Game of Perfect by Dr. Bob Rotella. Since I knew the problem was in my head, not my swing, the book instantly resonated with me, and I immediately put it into action, along with other advice I found on sports psychology. It helped, and my game continued to improve steadily over the next 3 years, except in big tournaments. Even though I earned All-American honors three times and won 9 tournaments in college, what I learned from sports psychology didn't prevent me from choking under intense pressure. My dreams of professional golf weren't entirely destroyed. I just had to figure out a solution to this problem. Since what was available in sports psychology at the time didn't work for me, I decided to go find my own answers. I knew I wasn't ready to play professional golf, but if I could figure out a solution, then I could play professionally and have another career option. I suspected that conventional sports psychology was lacking an understanding of the cause of mental game problems. The traditional wisdom in golf was much as it is now in poker. I was given techniques to increase focus, increase confidence, and reduce anxiety, but I didn't learn why I choked in the first place. At the time, I believed the reason was because of personal issues that I or other golfers faced, so I enrolled in Northeastern University for a master's degree in counseling to gain that skill. Yet what I discovered over the next 10 years is this. While personal issues certainly affect performance, mental game problems can happen for far more simple reasons. For example, hating to make mistakes, having high expectations, and having a poor work ethic. Following my degree and 3,200 hours of supervised practice to become licensed in traditional therapy, I took what I learned and started working with golfers as a mental game coach. Over the next 2.5 years, I coached more than 300, including top-ranked juniors, casual players, and professionals on the PGA Tour, Nationwide Tour, and LPGA Tour. One player won her first title shortly after I started coaching her. Enter poker. A stroke of good variance had me playing a round of golf at Bandon Dunes Golf Resort with Dusty Leather Ash Schmidt in the summer of 2007. Serendipitously, I met this professional golfer turned poker pro soon after I started to play professional golf myself. From his years in golf, Dusty already knew the importance of the mental game. So when he was on the verge of his first losing month as a pro and his pursuit of Supernova Elite being derailed by problems with tilt, he called me for help. Dusty was the perfect first poker client because of his background in golf. He knew my knowledge of poker was limited to home games and a few trips to Foxwoods Casino. To help me better understand poker, he often used golf terms to describe poker issues. The more we worked together, the more obvious the parallels between golf and poker became to me. The major differences are obviously the details of the game and the amount of variance. Golf has a lot of randomness, rub of the green as it's called, but it pales in comparison to the variance in poker. Having to sustain long stretches where skill does not equal results makes the mental game even more important in poker than in golf. It takes a strong mind to hold up under sustained bad runs, and back then, Dusty was really struggling with it. He was a good teacher and student. Applying his well-known work ethic to his mental game, Dusty made rapid improvement in preventing tilt and quickly paid for our sessions with the savings from computer equipment, mice, keyboards, and monitors that went unbroken. His wife even thanked me the first time we met. She could no longer tell when he won or lost. Client story. Dusty Leather Ash Schmidt, 3-6 to 25-50, no limit hold'em. PokerStars Team Online Pro. Author of Don't Listen to Phil Hellmuth and Treat Your Poker Like a Business.
Before I became a professional poker player, I played professional golf. As a golfer, I couldn't afford a sports psychologist, but I knew how powerful their impact was. Everyone on the PGA Tour had one. I always thought there was a big correlation between poker and golf, and I figured a sports psychologist could really help my poker game. So back in 2007, I contacted Jared Tindler to help me with some tilt problems. It took a few sessions before Jared got his head around poker, but I got some real instant benefits just from talking things out, and even more once he started to understand the game. As a poker player, I'm trained to get inside the heads of others, and Jared's role was very much the same thing. The biggest impact for me was not what he said, but how he understood my thought processes. I started to realize Jared was more or less the ultimate bullshit detector, and he wasn't afraid to call me out on everything. I mean, he literally wouldn't let me get away with anything. Ultimately, this forced me to operate in a much more logical way. So much of what we poker players deal with is illogical, and my struggles with variance were a big example of it. Jared once asked me, "When you look at a weather forecast and it says it's going to rain, do you get mad when you go out and it's raining? So why do you continually get angry when you know variance is going to happen?" I absolutely hate when I'm being illogical, and as soon as he reminded me that I was, I could instantly tell I was going to handle variance better. Rather than singing some mantra, doing breathing exercises, or trying to hypnotize me not to tilt, more than anything, Jared helped me just be more logical in how I approached the game. As Jared's first poker client, I'm now more in the maintenance phase. When we chat, he often finds some small leaks in my mental game. I don't think anybody owns anything forever. People's mindsets change, emotions change, so working with Jared keeps me on top of my game.
The dramatic improvements in Dusty's mental game prompted him to try to bring me on as a featured coach on Stocks Poker. Since no other training website had a mental game or mindset coach at the time, it was a great opportunity to expand my practice to poker. However, I was preparing for my first full year of professional golf. I had a choice to make, pursue my dream or pursue a career. Even though I was no longer choking and was playing the best golf of my life, becoming a successful pro golfer was a huge gamble that would take years to pay off. Even though my exposure to high-level poker was limited, poker seemed like the safe bet. I'm not a poker player. Jared Tendler invented the field as far as I'm concerned. Jesse May, the voice of poker. While I grew up playing all types of card games, including poker, high-level poker and the details of online poker were a whole new world to me. I had a lot of learning to do, and I was doing it on the job. I began feverishly studying the game to better understand what poker players needed from me, Now, more than 3 years later, I've coached more than 170 poker players from 25 countries and have helped thousands more by providing advice in training videos, on poker forums, and in magazine articles I've written. No one with my level of education and training has more experience working with poker players on the mental game than I do. I'm often asked how I can help poker players when I'm a fish in most games. The best way I can explain it is with an analogy. A mechanic working on a race car doesn't need to be a world-class driver to understand how to prepare a car to win. He needs to have a deep understanding of what the driver needs, the conditions the car will race in, and how the car works, and he must be able to diagnose and fix problems quickly. Now that I understand high-level poker, I know what poker players go through, what they need to consistently perform at their best, and how to help them become mentally stronger. I'm not a poker player, but when poker players run into trouble, I'm their mechanic. The problem with conventional poker psychology. My experience with sports psychology in the late 1990s is reflected in the comments I now get from clients about conventional poker psychology. It helps to a point, but it just doesn't stick, especially when it matters most. Most of the poker psychology I've been exposed to suggests combating bad variants and other mental game issues with general advice, deep breathing, taking breaks, visualization, meditation, neurolinguistic programming, and even hypnosis. Each of these strategies can be a great short-term option, but without resolving the underlying cause or causes of your mental game problems, they pop back up just as weeds grow back if you don't pull them out by their roots. My experience in poker has confirmed what I found with golfers. By adopting a deeper strategy for the mental game, permanent, not just temporary, solutions can be found. What's been missing from conventional poker psychology is depth in the theory and understanding of how to develop mental game skill in a real way. Conventional wisdom knows the end game, so players are told to be fearless, to be confident, and to not let variants piss them off. But for many players, that isn't enough. It's one thing to know the end game, and quite another to actually fix the problems preventing you from getting there. Mental game fish. Fish are fish in part because they believe things that aren't true. They play in games where they are major underdogs without realizing it. They suck out and believe they played great. They get schooled by another player and claim they were unlucky. They think their game doesn't need work, and even if they did, would have no idea where to start. They have no understanding of what they can and can't control at the table, and often think, "I knew the king was coming," or, "I always win with ace-queen." You may be a solid winning poker player who recognizes the shortcomings of a bad player, but as far as the mental game is concerned, you are likely no different. A solid player is a mental game fish if they 1. Change a proven winning strategy because they are running bad or hot. 2. Never recognize when someone has played well against them and or believe everyone they play against is bad and just gets lucky. 3. Try to win every hand. 4. Think the outcome of a hand can be changed by shouting, praying, or playing a favorite hand. 5. Get frustrated when a bad player plays badly, and they even educate them as to why they are bad. 6. Feel like a failure when they lose a hand that was played profitably. 7. Think the solution to running bad is to stop playing or change stakes. 8. Read a poker book cover to cover and think they know everything in it. 9. Watch some of Phil Galfond's training videos, and they think they should now be able to crush the game like him. 10. Believe they are cursed or that other people are luckier than they are. 11. Believe it's possible to own another player's soul. 12. Play more hands when they are winning or losing. 13. Play fewer hands when they are winning or losing. 14. Play badly when the stakes are too small for them to care. 15. Allow things to get personal with another regular. 16. Tell bad beat stories to anyone that will listen while doing nothing to improve how they react to bad beats. 17. Say one time. Mental game strategy. Think of the mental game as an actual game. As with any other game, winning requires skill and a good strategy. While having a strategy is not a new idea, having a strategy for the mental game may be. Winning in the mental game, so to speak, is fundamentally no different than learning to play winning poker. You need talent, hard work, and the right information. The only one of those you don't control is talent. Some players are naturally more talented than you in the mental game. For example, things that piss you off barely even raise their heartbeat, or they have no trouble playing poker all day while you struggle to grind longer than an hour. Seeing the natural mental game talents of others can make it seem as if it should be easy for you too. Wrong. It's easy for them because they have more talent. Fortunately, if you are lacking talent in the mental game, hard work and the right information can eventually make it easy for you too. Many players also believe that solutions to mental game problems are easy because common poker wisdom makes it sound that way. So you'll hear, just stay calm, don't let it tilt you. Don't focus on the money. Make the right decision. Or, take a deep breath, be fearless. These all sound nice, but they are the poker equivalent of saying, just win the hand. That, of course, is the whole challenge of the game, to develop a strategy to win the hand. In the mental game, the challenge is to develop a strategy so you can remain calm, focus on the decision and not the money, and not let fear affect your decision. It's not as easy as common wisdom makes it sound. Mental game myths. There are many myths about the mental game. If you're going to have real success in the mental game, you need a strategy based on sound logic and the most up-to-date research. Otherwise, you'll actually create more emotional problems and end up wasting a lot of time and effort. Your strategy is flawed if you are incorporating these common myths into your mental game. Emotions are a problem and need to be blocked out at all times. You either have mental game talent or you don't. Changing a habit is as simple as saying, don't do it. You should always quit if you think you're about to tilt. You can win by visualizing yourself winning. The key to surviving downswings is to take breaks or to drop down in stakes. Playing your A game is random. The mental game is deep, complicated, and mysterious. How to use this book? Here are some suggestions and notes about the book so you can get the most out of it. 1. This book covers the four central areas of every poker player's mental game: tilt, fear, motivation, and confidence. There are other areas that are important, such as focus, discipline, decision-making, and playing in the zone. However, by first working on tilt, fear, motivation, and confidence, you'll automatically improve the other areas. The reverse is not true, which is why we start here. 2. There is an interrelationship among issues that can be important to look at closely. For example, motivation issues can be caused by tilt, confidence issues can be caused by fear, tilt can be caused by confidence problems, and so on. Remember, you're a mental game fish, so don't assume you know the cause of your problem. Start with what you know, and then use this book to help you figure out the real problem. 3. You may find there's a lot to work on in your mental game. Since you can't work on everything all at once, it's important to prioritize. There are many ways to prioritize what to work on first. Here are a few. Address smaller problems first, because they're often the easiest to fix. Fix problems that are the most costly. Fix problems that happen most often. Fix problems that cause the most emotional turmoil. 4. It's like a choose-your-own-adventure book. You can skip around to chapters or sections of this book that are most relevant to you after you have read chapters 2, 3, and 4. Also keep in mind that sections may not appear relevant when they actually are. Avoid discounting them too quickly. 5. Do not read this book cover to cover and expect to know it all. The process of improvement is more like chopping down a tree with an axe rather than cutting it down with a huge chainsaw. It happens steadily over time. Keep this book close by as you gradually and systematically work on different parts of your mental game. Mastery in any game is a moving target, so there's always something to work on in your mental game. 6. Questions are posed to you throughout the book. Take some time to reflect and answer these questions as if you're being asked them directly. It makes the material in the book more relevant to you and prevents you from being tricked into thinking you have every problem you read about. Ideally, you'll also write the answers down. 7. When rushing to understand your mental game, it can be easy to get overloaded with information. As it does in poker, having too much information can make you confused. Going slowly through the book or specific sections may make it seem like it takes longer to fix your problems, when in the long run, it's often faster. 8. Do what works. People are diverse, so it's hard to know what's going to work best for you. Start by following the strategies provided in each chapter to gain experience. Then, use your judgment to adjust your strategy to what makes sense for you. It's no different than taking a new poker concept and molding it to fit your game. 9. Don't literally follow every word of what's written in the book. Even if it fits you perfectly, still take a step back to think about how each point applies specifically to you. Doing so helps you learn the material and personalize the strategies. 10. After working on your mental game in poker, you can start applying the techniques in this book to things outside of poker, such as sports, business, investing, exercise, dating, and relationships. By also using them outside of poker, you're in effect cross-training, which helps you to learn and improve your poker mental game. That's especially true when the same problem happens in poker and outside of it. Chapter 2, Foundation. Errors in the way players view learning and performance can cause mental game problems. When players know what to expect, they aren't fighting against what they think is true, and instead can work within the reality of what is true. Problems with tilt, fear, motivation, and confidence can be eliminated simply by better understanding how to learn and perform. This chapter details the three theories that form the foundation of an organized and logical structure to improve your mental game. Later in the chapter, one client describes how he used these theories to solve his tilt problem. The three foundational theories are: the adult learning model describes the four distinct levels of the learning process. Inchworm shows how improvement happens over time. The process model makes it easier to consistently play your best and improve over time. In the short term, understanding how to better learn and perform might make things seem more complex, but in the long run, you'll have the information necessary to make solving your mental game problems simpler. In addition, these three theories can be used to improve your actual poker skill. The adult learning model. When learning a particular skill, the process is predictable and has a distinct start and finish. While players differ in the unique aspects of learning, such as how quickly they learn, what comes easily to them, and where they get stuck, the overall process is exactly the same. The adult learning model, ALM for short, is a straightforward theory that defines the four distinct levels of the learning process. The four levels are: Level 1, unconscious incompetence. You don't even know what you don't know. In other words, you're blind to the ways that you lack skill, which isn't necessarily good or bad. For some players, ignorance is bliss. Level 2, conscious incompetence. Now you've become conscious of what you don't know. But that doesn't make you skilled. It just means you know what skills you need to improve. Becoming conscious happens from either your own insight or insight that is shared with you by someone else. Level 3, conscious competence. If you've reached this level, it means you've done some work and/or had enough repetition to gain some skill. The only catch is that in order to be skilled, you need to think about what you've learned. Otherwise, you return to being incompetent. Level 4, unconscious competence. At this level, you've learned something so well that it is now totally automatic and requires no thinking. Unconscious competence is the holy grail of learning, and by far the most important concept in this book. These levels make sense when you begin to think about your own experience in learning poker or just about anything else. A familiar example that shows the ALM in action is learning to drive a car. Remember when you were a small child thinking about driving a car? You barely knew what a car was, let alone how to drive one. This is unconscious incompetence. Then, as a teenager, you become much more aware of driving and perhaps were frustrated by the fact that you couldn't drive. You became conscious of your incompetence. Now think back to when you got behind the wheel for the first time. In order to drive a car, you first needed to learn how to steer, step on the gas, watch the road, and change the radio station all at the same time, parallel park, adjust to the speed of highway traffic, and deal with thousands of unique situations. Then, you needed to concentrate and think about all of these things so you didn't kill yourself or others. This is conscious competence. After driving for years, you no longer need to think about every single action needed to drive a car. Your skill comes naturally and with little effort. You can handle driving, listening to music, talking to passengers, and extreme situations that arise, such as adverse weather, all without much thought. Driving is a skill now trained to the level of unconscious competence. To begin looking at how the ALM applies to poker, take a minute to think about: 1. how much you knew the first time you played poker. 2, the complexity of your thought process when making poker decisions now compared to when you first started really trying to improve. 3, a mistake you recently discovered. 4, decisions at the table that are made automatically. 5, mistakes that don't happen anymore. Flaws are skills. Within your unconscious competence are also flaws or old habits in your technical poker game as well as your mental game. Basically, you're really good at these bad habits, but you no longer want to be. A good example from poker that demonstrates the levels of the ALM is starting hand selection. When playing for the first time, you may not have even been aware of the concept and played too many hands. Even with some knowledge of starting hands, the first time you played, it's unlikely you had any clue of why calling a 3-bet out of position with queen-jack off is a mistake. So whether you were unconsciously incompetent about the concept as a whole or just the finer details, in some way, this was a weakness and you didn't know it. Fast forward to a few weeks or months after you started learning more about how to play poker and specifically hand selection. You may have picked up information about it from a friend or a book that advocates the value of certain hands from certain positions, from an opponent who berated you for playing queen-jack off, or from playing more you started to realize you were second best far too often. You weren't sure which hands you should be playing yet, but you did realize something was off. Simply realizing you were making mistakes in hand selection didn't mean you were good at it, just that you needed to work on it. An easy way to know you're at the level of conscious incompetence is that you've recognized a mistake for the first time. After playing and studying more, you know the pluses and minuses of all the possible starting hands. It feels as if you're improving, you're in control of the hands you're playing, and things are good. Until you lose focus at the end of a long session, or you're frustrated having lost a few big pots. Now suddenly you fall back into old habits and start playing hands you know you shouldn't. The mistakes are obvious afterwards, but that only reinforces the reality that you actually don't know the correct hands to play as well as you thought. At this point in the learning process, you still need to think about which hands to play, otherwise you make mistakes. After more experience, more work, and more learning, your job is finally complete. Now when you're dealt marginal hands, even on tilt, you muck them without a thought, an insta-fold. It's a new habit or decision made automatically. A lot of work is needed to get here, and the benefit is well worth it. Now you no longer need to think about starting hands to be good at it. And because of that, your mind is free to learn something new. Whether it's starting hands or tilt control, there's a limit to how much your mind can think about in a given moment. You can only work on parts of your game at one time. As a result, it's critical to know the level of the ALM your skills are in, so you know what to focus on improving. If you no longer need to think to be good, you have more mental space to work on another weakness in your game and move it eventually from conscious incompetence to the level of unconscious competence. However, if you fall back into old habits, you clearly need more work no matter what you thought. In reality, the learning process has many more small steps than the ALM specifies, but as an overall theory, it's brilliantly simple and incredibly important to your game. Inchworm. Inchworm is a concept with a strange name that helps to make the process of improving over time easier to understand. Inchworm isn't a revolutionary new idea. It's just an observation of how you improve over time and something you likely never thought about previously. Understanding this concept more clearly will help you to become more efficient in your approach to improving, make consistent improvement while avoiding common pitfalls, avoid fighting a reality you can't change, know where a skill is in the learning process, handle the natural ups and downs of learning better. There will be times when it feels like you have taken a huge step backwards, not progressed at all, or fallen back into old habits. The next time this happens, come back to this section. Understanding the concept of inchworm starts by looking more closely at the natural range that exists in the quality of your poker or mental game. Think for a moment about the quality of your poker decisions when playing your absolute best and when playing at your worst. In other words, how good does it get when you're playing great, and how bad does it get when you're playing poorly? To illustrate a point, let's say that you rated the quality of every decision you made at the poker table, your best, worst, and everything in between, over the last 6 to 12 months, on a scale of 1, worst, or 100, best, and plotted them on a graph. What you'd see on that graph is a bell curve. A bell curve looks like the outline of a bell on a graph. The right side of the bell represents your best decisions or your A game. The left side represents your worst decisions or your C game. and the center of the bell represents your average decisions or your B game. This bell curve shows the natural range that exists in your game and the game of every poker player on the planet, even short stackers, although theirs is the narrowest. As long as you're playing poker, you'll always have aspects of your game that represent the peak of your ability and the flip side, your worst. Always. Perfect poker isn't possible over a large number of hands. There are times you play perfectly and other times that you don't. Poker is a dynamic game that's becoming more competitive. This means that the definition of perfection, even just solid play, is a moving target. As long as your game evolves, that means you're learning. If you're learning, that means there's range in the quality of your decision making. Poker isn't the only instance where range exists. It's everywhere you look, especially in professional sports. Take any player in a major professional sport and evaluate the quality of their skill set over a large enough sample and you'll see a bell curve. Baseball players hit home runs and make diving catches as well as strike out and make errors. Quarterbacks throw perfect 40-yard passes into tight coverage and then throw terrible interceptions. Soccer players make sharp passes to set up an incredible goal and also whiff or shank the ball. When looking more closely at your game, for better or worse, it's important to be honest about the reality of the range that exists. Not what you wish the reality to be, but what it actually is. Take a look at the strengths in your decision-making represented by the right side of your bell curve. These are decisions that happen when your thinking is perfect, so they come easily because you have a solid understanding of your opponents and you're in the flow of the game. Generally, you have a great mindset and are in the zone. The right side also includes new information gained from your own insights, training videos, talking with other players, etc., which allows you to make even better decisions than usual. Remember, these are skills at the level of conscious competence and cannot yet be counted as solid parts of your game. On the other side of the bell curve are all the terrible decisions you make. These are the mistakes you know you shouldn't be making, but still do. Often these are directly connected to mental game problems, such as your mind going blank in a huge pot and folding the obvious best hand, misreading an opponent because you're bored and your terrible bluff gets called, or tilting and played too many hands way too aggressively. Clearly, these are all things you want out of your game because they not only cost you a lot of money, but they create more frustration, confusion, and confidence problems. This book is designed to help you improve the back end of your mental game range, which means that not only will these obvious poker mistakes go away, you'll also play closer to your mental peak more frequently. The concept of inchworm comes in when you look at how the range in your poker game or mental game improves over time. A bell curve is a snapshot of a given sample, while improvement is the movement of a bell curve over time, something an actual inchworm illustrates perfectly in the way it moves. An inchworm actually looks like a bell curve, similar in shape to the worms that slither through the dirt. Inchworms only differ in that they're shorter and move on top of the ground. To move, they use tiny feet in the front and back sections of their body. If you've never seen the way an inchworm moves, it starts by stretching its body straight, anchors the front foot, then lifts up from the back end, bends at the middle to bring the two ends closer together, anchors the back foot, then stretches its body straight again and takes another step forward. When you reach a new peak in your ability, the front end of your range takes a step forward. Your best just became better, which also means that your range has widened because the worst part of your game hasn't moved yet. The most efficient way to move forward again is to turn your focus to the back end of your range and make improvements to your greatest weaknesses. By eliminating what is currently the worst part of your game, your bell curve takes a step forward from the back end, and now it's easier to take another step forward from the front. The inchworm concept illustrates how consistent improvement happens by taking one step forward from the front of your bell curve, followed by another step forward from the back. The implications of this concept are that 1. Improvement happens from two sides, improving weaknesses and improving your best. 2. Playing your best is a moving target because it's always relative to the current range in your game. 3. You create the potential for an even greater A game when you eliminate your mental and poker C games, because mental space is freed up to learn new things. Yes, the quality of your mental peak or zone can actually improve as well. Client story. Neiman Simoleas Kenkri, 5'10 to 2550, No Limit Hold'em. Blue Fire Poker Coach.
It's kind of unusual. I actually started talking with Jared when I was on a real tear and at the top of my game. I'd been a successful pro for more than 5 years, but had a really rough patch at the end of 2009. I was playing really poorly and was screwed up a bit mentally. I sorted out my game on my own and went to Jared when I was playing well, because I thought in a better state of mind, I would get more out of it. Plus, I figured working with him might prevent my game from slipping again. I was really skeptical working with a mental game coach. What was he going to tell me that I hadn't heard before? I expected goofy stuff like, stay calm, don't worry about results, visualize yourself winning, blah, 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 stuff you read in forums. I was really surprised. Jared had a fantastic system of learning, and it had a real immediate and emphatic effect on me. He talked about concepts such as inchworm in a context that I never thought about. Realizing how the front end fits with my back end was eye-opening. I always thought of my A game and my F game as two separate things. Jared helped me understand how they work together, which made it very systematic and clear how to improve myself overall as a player. I now understand that when I'm playing my worst game, I have to work hard to make it a little better, so it won't be as bad tomorrow. I also didn't understand how emotions were part of the learning model. Surprisingly, just knowing more about that completely removed the effect negative emotions had on my play. Previously, I would take bad beats and have bad players get rewarded, and I would react like a caveman.
That guy was stealing my money.
I didn't have a framework to understand those emotions, and then everything would go haywire. The whole concept of unconscious competence helped to totally change all that, as well as how I went about working on my game. Unconscious competence may be the single most important thing Jared taught me. When I was on tilt, one of my leaks would be that I would get frustrated when players 3-bet me in position with hands they should not be playing. I would overplay my hands and get really tilted at how they were playing. It was my weakest area, and I knew I wasn't playing well, but couldn't wrap my head around it. Jared laughed and asked, "So your opponents are not allowed to play in a way that puts you at your weakest?" Seeing it in that context made me realize instantly that my emotional reaction was trying to protect my greatest weakness. I fixed the leak, and now, when I encounter those situations, my head is much better. It's still frustrating, but my play doesn't go haywire, because playing well in that situation is now learned to the level of unconscious competence. Now, every day that I play, I think of my play in the context of the learning model. My tilt-induced emotions come up far less frequently, and when they do come up, they don't affect my play as much as they used to. That's another important thing I took away from Jared. After a couple sessions, I assumed I was supposed to have the zen-like state of mind and shouldn't get tilted by bad beats because I now understood. Now, every day that I play, I think of my play in the context of the learning model. My tilt-induced emotions come up far less frequently, and when they do come up, they don't affect my play as much as they used to. That's another important thing I took away from Jared. After a couple sessions, I assumed I was supposed to have this zen-like state of mind and shouldn't get tilted by bad beats because I now understood. Emotions are going to be there. And just knowing that makes them easier to handle. I've been a pro poker player now for 5 years, and there's been no greater positive influence on my game than my lessons with Jared, and nothing else even comes close.
Two common learning mistakes. To further understand how the inchworm applies specifically to poker, here are two common mistakes players often make, along with a solution for each. Ignoring weaknesses. When players constantly learn new things, while avoiding, ignoring, blocking out, or protecting weaknesses, their bell curve gets flatter and flatter. Weaknesses haven't improved, so the back end doesn't move. They also have a bunch of new skills to use, so when they're at their best, they're better than ever. The problem is that by exclusively learning new things, they create a wide range in their game, which means that it takes a lot of mental effort to think through all these new concepts. If you aren't mentally sharp, there's a dramatic drop-off in your play. So when you're at your best, you're better than ever. But when your play goes bad, it gets really bad. Here are a few other consequences for this approach to learning. Playing your best takes a lot of energy, so it doesn't happen that often. Mistakes, many of them basic, show up completely out of nowhere. It feels as if you stopped improving and your game has plateaued. You have a lot to think about and often get confused or missed important details of a hand. To make matters worse, all the new information you've acquired is in the process of being learned, so it won't show up when you go on tilt, lose focus, get tired, or are nervous in a huge pot. When any of those mental game problems happen, It feels as if you've just had the carpet yanked out from under you, and now you're lying on the floor, the backside of your bell curve, with your confidence shattered, wondering what the hell just happened. For some players, this leads them to question everything in their game, which accelerates the free fall like an airplane in a death spiral. The consequences of not working on your weaknesses and exclusively learning new things could be the difference between being a slight loser and a solid winner. Preventing this from happening is actually quite simple. You must stay focused on learning the correction to your weaknesses until it is trained to the level of unconscious competence, especially after your A game improves. Doing so keeps you humble, reminds you of your weaknesses, and is the most efficient way for your best to improve. Comparing your worst to your best. Inchworm also has another important lesson that comes in handy when your game is under pressure from being on a bad run, on tilt, or having poor motivation and focus. During these times, it's especially hard to maintain proper perspective, especially for improvement in your poker and mental games. While actually recognizing improvement may not seem like much, it can actually be critical in helping to turn things around. The only way that you can prove the back end of your game has taken a step forward is by analyzing your game at its worst and comparing it with your worst during a previous tough stretch. So rather than comparing your game at its worst to your recent peak, which can seem like miles away and make you feel worse, instead compare apples to apples, or your worst to your previous worst. Remember, it's under intense pressure that you rely heavily on skills at the level of unconscious competence. So for better or worse, what shows up at that point gives you a perfect view of the greatest weaknesses in your game. Comparing your worst to your previous worst allows you to prove that the back end of your range has improved. For example, you might not be completely tilt-free, but compared to before, you are more aware of your tilt pattern, manage your tilt better so you play better longer, and quit sooner when it's no longer possible to recover a solid thought process. Basically, you're looking to see your worst improve, and seeing that you have improved in the midst of a tough stretch can give you a much-needed confidence boost. The process model. The process model organizes the naturally recurring parts of your entire poker game so you can put the principles of the ALM and Inchworm into action day after day. The net result is consistently playing at a high level while also making steady improvement in your poker and mental games. The process model also applies to a single hand, a single session or tournament, a month of playing, a year, or a career. The process model doesn't invent anything new, but it provides some order to things you already do, creates a foundation to achieve mastery, improves results-oriented thinking, and ultimately leads to more consistent play. The process model has five parts that all work together. 1. Preparation or warm-up. What you do before you play. Whether it's planned, random, or nothing at all, it's how you prepare. 2. Performance. Playing poker. 3. Results. The outcome of your play. 4. Evaluation. A review of your results right after playing. 5. Analysis. Actively working to improve your game away from the table. The process model is something that applies to anything in life involving performance. You've already used it in countless areas of your life, such as sports, dating, music, art, writing, business, and of course poker. Even if you weren't aware at the time that you were using the process model, in some way you were. Here is a more detailed look at the process model when it's applied to professional American football and poker. Preparation or warm-up. In professional football, preparation starts shortly after the last game and ends just before kickoff. Throughout the week, coaches and players review game tape, run drills, lift weights, analyze opponents, formulate a strategy, and practice that strategy, all with the intent of getting ready to play at a high level and win. The day of the game, players and the coaches follow a structured routine to warm up their bodies, focus their minds, and review their tactical strategy so they're ready to compete. They run drills, rehearse plays, listen to music, double-check equipment, and fire each other up. While the details are very different in poker, the intent of preparation remains the same: to be ready to perform at your best and win. Part of the reason preparation is so important in poker is because of the range that exists in the quality of your game. Every time you sit down to play, you could play great, or you could play terribly. Preparation provides a way to make it more likely that you'll perform in the front end of your ability, and less likely that your worst will show up. How you prepare is a matter of personal preference that is based on your overall goals. There are no hard and fast rules for what makes preparation ideal, because ultimately it's all about doing what makes the most sense for you. Here are some general things you can do to prepare to play. Review your long-term goals and set goals for the session. Review a list with the corrections to your common poker mistakes. Review your strategy for improving mental game issues. Use deep breathing, meditation, and or visualization to help steady and focus your mind. Listen to a favorite song. For more instruction on how to prepare, go to Appendix 1. Client story. Dusty Leather Ash Schmidt, 36 to 2550, No Limit Hold'em. PokerStars Team Online Pro, author of Don't Listen to Phil Hellmuth and Treat Your Poker Like a Business.
Before I started working with Jared, I didn't warm up before I played, which made me more vulnerable to the effects of a downswing. I really didn't want to get upset if I had a bad run. Getting upset would make me stupid, and I didn't want to be stupid. More than anything, I didn't want to get called out on my bullshit again by Jared. So we developed a pre-game routine that prepared me for a bad run. The warm-up is essential. I always knew how detrimental it would be for me not to warm up before a golf tournament. Really, I never even thought about not doing it. Now I feel the same way about poker. This was proven to me recently when I got on some waiting list before I had warmed up properly. Seats started popping up. Seats that happened to be the Jesus seats you can't pass up. So F the mental routine, I started playing. Within the first 5 to 10 minutes, my hand on the mouse started shaking. I know from years of experience that I only tend to get nervous when I don't know what I'm doing. In golf, that happens when my putting stroke gets off and I'm under tournament pressure. I'm loosey-goosey when I know what I'm doing. But my hand started shaking that day at the tables because I hadn't prepared and wasn't mentally ready to deal with terrible cards. I didn't play my best and the session snowballed. No matter what, I always warm up now.
Performance. In football, playing the game is the player's and coach's only opportunity to put their skills and hard work to the test. Their performance includes everything from the first play of the game to the last. Performance in poker is just as obvious and doesn't need to be repeated. However, what isn't obvious are the consequences when preparation or evaluation occurs while you're playing. Ideally, preparation has you ready to play at a high level from the start of your session. If you do nothing to prepare beforehand, the beginning of your session is your preparation. That may mean you'll play marginally for the first 10 to 15 minutes until your mind is fully into the action. Consequently, you're less focused and you make mistakes. You fail to pick up reads on an opponent that set up future mistakes and became susceptible to other mental game problems. Ideally, evaluation only happens after the session when you can objectively look closely at how you played. This is typically more relevant online than live. However, players often review hands in the middle of a session, fixate on past hands looking for mistakes, run equity calculations, and check Hold'em Manager or Poker Tracker. Basically, they are evaluating how they are playing while they are playing. In other words, they're multitasking, and they play worse for that reason alone. Removing evaluation doesn't mean eliminating adjustments. Adjusting to your opponents is how you stay at least one step ahead of them while you're playing. Adjustments are key. Evaluating while playing is excessive. If you are spending too much time reviewing previous hands, your adjustments aren't known well enough. Ideally, they should be so well known that they are made automatically and without thought, unconscious competence. Otherwise, you're no different from a quarterback making up a play at the line of scrimmage rather than calling an audible, a predetermined alternate play his teammates already know well. Instead of evaluating, mark the hand or take a quick note and refocus on the action. Results-oriented thinking. Not being results-oriented gets a lot of attention in the poker world these days. The solution most often given is to ignore, block out, or detach from your results. Players know it's a mistake to focus too much on short-term results because of variance, but stopping is easier said than done. When you only focus on wins and losses, your emotions go on a roller coaster because they are attached to money and winning. Being focused on winning and money in the short run is not what causes problems. It's the set of results you're ignoring. You also need to focus on qualitative results so your emotions can attach to factors that you have 100% control of in the short run. The process model provides the structure and the organization to capture qualitative results since they aren't easily calculated at the end of a session or tournament. Use the model to focus more and more on the quality of your play, your mental game, and overall improvement, and steadily your emotions will reorganize around this set of results. Results. In both football and poker, there are many ways to measure the outcome of a player's performance. Typically, poker players think of results mainly in terms of things easily quantified, such as money, wins and losses, number of hands and hours played, and win rate. However, it's also essential to account for qualitative results, such as how well you played, your level of focus, the degree of tilt control, and your improvement of weaknesses. Evaluation. The first opportunity to gain an objective view about what happened during play is immediately after you finish playing. When you're actually playing, whether it's football or poker, you play your best by focusing intensely on the game itself and far less on how you are playing. After football games, the media instantly rush over to speak with players and coaches to get their reactions. What they share is a quick snapshot of a few things they noticed or how they feel in the moment, but it's not solid details. Once back in the locker room, players talk with each other and have more time to reflect on the game. Coaches also start a formal review of player performance, going through game tape and reviewing their own decisions to get an initial impression of what needs work before the next game. Poker players tend to overly focus on money immediately after a session because it matters most in the long run, and it's so easy to calculate. The problem is that because of variance, monetary results alone are unreliable measures in the short term of how you played. Here are a few better ways to evaluate how you played. Look closely at tough decisions to see how you played them. Estimate how much variance influenced results. Calculate whether you accomplished the qualitative goals you set before the session. If you fell short, why? Review how you did in the areas you're trying to improve, poker strategy and mental game. Did you see any progress? If you're going to analyze hands later, write some game flow notes or thoughts about them that you may otherwise forget. Spending a short time to evaluate is also a great way to put poker down when you're done playing so you can go on with your life. Reset your mind before the next time you play. Client story. Neiman Simoleas Kenkri, 5'10 to 2550, no limit hold'em. Blue Fire Poker Coach.
I don't use a HUD, but have always kept a spreadsheet for tax purposes. In addition to putting in amount of time, stakes, and net profit for the day, I also have a column for my comments, which previously had just been things like, stupid freaking donkey sucked out on me. After working with Jared, I now have two other columns. One is a rating where I evaluate the quality of my play, and the other is a comment about the quality of how I handled my emotions. Now I find myself striving to play and manage my emotions really well. I am less focused on my profit and more on my rating. I want to be able to put a 9 or 9.5 for my play, and that's how I define my success. I find myself being able to do that honestly. For example, I had a losing session a couple of days ago, but felt I played tremendously well. I gave myself a high rating and walked away from the day feeling very good.
Analysis. Analysis is the stage where you actively work on your game away from the action. It's the best time to go into greater detail assessing your play and your opponent's play, as well as bring in any additional resources to ensure you're a stronger player. In football, this includes a more detailed analysis of the game tape,